Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. There's an enormous amount of news stories out there. I mean, the Savage Nation is, sure, it's news talk, but it could be history talk. It could be the moonwalk. And right now what we have is a dictatorship run by a gang. It's a gang under Obama, although I think he's the front man. I think that soon they're going to realize that he's more intelligent than they originally thought, and they're going to find out that they're going to be left out in the cold. But that's going to take a little while before the Rahm Emanuel gang realizes that Obama has outsmarted them and he's not just their front man. There is only one other country on earth that I know of that is currently conducting a campaign against the media that criticizes the regime, and that is Hugo Chavez's dictatorship in Venezuela. Right now, Obama is either copying Chavez or they're both reading from the same playbook. In that, you well know it, Obama is attacking Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is a perfect person for them to attack in that he has been carrying the water for the Republican Party for many years, and he's entitled to do that. And certainly if I had to choose between backing Rush Limbaugh and backing the Obama gang, I would choose Rush Limbaugh. I am glad they're attacking Rush because eventually the American people will come to understand the dangerous gang that has taken over this country. The fact of the matter is it's unprecedented in the United States of America for a sitting administration to attack someone in the media who criticizes them. I do not know that this has occurred to this extent. I am not aware of it. So if you wish to correct me, you can call me at 1-800-449-8255. I'm trying to show you that the gang, the Obama gang, is showing their true nature on a daily basis. Yesterday, I tried to educate you and enlighten you by reading from Sinclair Lewis's great book, It Can't Happen Here, written during the Great Depression. Some would argue that this is a greater depression that's only simply being masked over or stuccoed over by the Obama maniacs with their insane spending. But it was written, published in 1935, I believe. And I talked about the 15 points of victory that would be announced by the candidate for the United States presidency should a dictatorship arise. And Sinclair Lewis feared it would be a right-wing dictatorship. But, of course, at this point, it doesn't matter what the dictatorship, whether it comes from the right or the left. It's coming from the left in the form of Obama. The first thing that they talked about was this. One, all finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks, and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank owned by the government and conducted by a board appointed by the president, which board shall, without need of recourse to Congress for legislative authorization, be empowered to make all regulations governing finance. Thereafter, as soon as may be practicable, this said board shall consider the nationalization and government ownership for the profit of the whole people of all mines, oil fields, water power, public utilities, transportation, and communications. Now, that was his dark nightmare of what would happen if a right-wing dictatorship arose in America. Sinclair Lewis wrote that in 35. This, of course, has already occurred in Chavez's Venezuela, where there is no longer a middle class. They all fled. They fled to America. Obama is another Chavez. Make no mistake about it. I don't care what they say. They are acting out a dictatorship. That's step number one. Shall I read the rest of what they predicted would happen? Shall we talk about what happens with the labor unions under a dictatorship? Would you like to hear about that? What else would you like to hear about? Because we can talk about limiting net income per person and no accumulated fortune at any time shall exceed a certain amount of $1 million per person. Anybody who earns more than that and accumulates more than a certain amount will be seized. The excess will be seized by the federal government for use in relief and administrative expenses. That's what Timothy Geithner, the Cub Scout, is proposing right now, which is taxing the successful to support the illegal alien and the bum. How about the rest of this? The size of the military. Congress shall have the sole right to issue money, and immediately upon our inauguration, it shall at least double the present supply of money in order to facilitate the fluidity of credit. I'm not making this up. This is what a great fiction writer wrote in 1935 could happen in a fictional America should a right-winger take over America. Point eight, Congress shall at least double the present supply of money in order to facilitate the fluidity of credit. Shall I go on? Because, ladies and gentlemen, many of you don't understand that we are living in a dictatorship, albeit an early sign of dictatorship, albeit the infancy of dictatorship, albeit the baby steps of dictatorship, but you're only 2 months into the dictatorship. And I want you to use your brains. I want you to use your imagination if you can. Those of you who are not, those of you who are capable of thinking, and I don't know how many Americans are still capable of it, I want you to project ahead. I want you to take the arc of where this gang has taken us in 2 months. They've printed money to an unprecedented level. They've seized control of virtually all avenues of finance on Wall Street and in the banking industry. They've nationalized many of the largest banks by lending them money against their will. What do you think that was? It was a power grab, idiot. Some of the banks said no. They said you have to take the money. In other words, they put their hooks into them. How does the mafia work? They lend you money. Then they charge you phenomenal interest called vigorish, and you never pay back the principal. The government is like the mafia right now. The government has put the hooks into the bank, the banks, by forcing them to take money, and then when they can't pay it back, they take control over the banks. So there it is. Timothy Geithner is a little Cub Scout. Now, I'm trying to explain to you what's going on, and most of you are too stupid to understand it. You have no brains whatsoever. Here's an example of a guy, Michael in Las Vegas, who I'm sure does not understand what I'm saying. But oh, go ahead, Michael, go ahead. You're on the show.
Well, what has Obama done so far that is making you say that he's Chavez or whoever you're comparing him to?
Well, so again, are you stupid, sir? Are you deaf or stupid or both? Let me read it to you again. I realize you may not be able to even hear because your mind is so brainwashed, there's nothing left between the ears. All finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks, and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank. Do you understand what that means?
Yeah. Has he done that?
Has he done that? Has he not done that?
I'm asking you, has he done that?
Has he not done that? I'm asking you, has he not done that?
No, he hasn't.
Oh, he hasn't? What do you think he has done with the banks by forcing them to take billions of dollars in loans? What has he done?
What
has he done by bailing out AIG Insurance, the largest insurer in America, and by yesterday agreeing to give them another $150 billion? What has he done there by taking over the major player in the insurance industry?
He's trying to save it. If he doesn't do it, what?
You see, you're a moron. I told you you're too stupid. You don't deserve freedom. You were born to have understand that you're being enslaved. You don't deserve freedom. You don't deserve freedom. I'm only addressing people who understand what freedom is. Obviously, there are many people out there who don't even comprehend the magnitude of what is going on. They can't understand this. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. The show is called Michael Savage. The website is called michaelsavage.com. All finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks, and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank. We're, what, 85% there? They don't yet own the stocks and bonds, but they more or less own the banking industry. They more or less own the insurance industry. And by bailing out investment banks on Wall Street, owned by their friends in Goldman Sachs, etc., they have, in essence, taken over these banks, these investment banks. I also read to you another factor that would indicate we are living in a dictatorship. Congress shall have the sole right to issue money. Well, they certainly do. You can't issue your own money. And they shall at least double the present supply of money in order to facilitate the fluidity of credit. That was a projection of what would happen if a dictatorship arose. Has Obama increased the present supply of money? Yes. Has he doubled the present supply of money? No. But he hasn't done that overnight. He's done it in 2 months. He has greatly increased the supply of money by printing money. But if you add up his budget over the next few years, meaning what he's going to spend, he has more than doubled the amount of currency being printed, because that's what he's going to pay for it with. Don't you understand what he's doing? Don't you understand how this is working? I realize many of you want to live in a dictatorship because you have no self-control, and fundamentally you really don't care who controls you because you can't control yourself. In a way, it's a demonic wish to be controlled by somebody, and you wish that this man is going to be a benevolent dictator. But if dictatorships around the world are any indication of what kind of dictatorship the Obama regime will become, should they not be opposed, I assure you it will not be a benign dictatorship. We have an early dictatorship. It is no longer crawling. It is now walking. The Frankenstein of Obama is now a walking dictatorship. I'll be right back. Savage. It is the Savage Nation. It's a pretty amazing thing that's going on. I mean, people voted against Bush. There's no question about it. But as you well know, it was a fairly close election. They did not vote for socialism. They certainly didn't vote for a dictatorship. They did not vote for a whole host of radical leftist policies which are being jammed down the throats of the people. Only they know that they have 4 years to do it and lie to you about it. And to top it all off, we have Gordon Brown, the beggar from England, coming to America and demanding that we have a global bailout, in other words, and that we don't have any protectionism, meaning we don't support America and American workers. We support the workers of the world, unite. You know, there used to be a phrase from the Communist Manifesto called workers of the world, unite. And what you have here in the New World Order is fundamentally a soft form of communism or Marxism. Many of you are so uneducated, you don't understand this. Now you say, well, what do I care what you call it? You right-wingers, what do you care? What do we care what it is? As long as we have gays getting married, as long as we prevent those glaciers from melting, even though they're not melting, as long as we have all of our agendas, we don't care if we're slaves. We don't care if we're slaves. You are slaves by your activities. You are slaves if you go to nightclubs every night looking for sex. That makes you a slave. You're an addict. Do you understand that? That you are a slave? And that's why you don't mind being enslaved by the Obama regime? But there are millions of us who are not slaves. We are free men. We are Americans. And you're not going to do this, I can assure you. You're not going to do this without a fight. San Francisco Steve, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Michael. All that they are doing, I mean, I think the analogy to Sinclair Lewis is specious. Sinclair Lewis talks of a person arising sort of de novo, and a government arising and de novo taking over all these controls that you mentioned. These policies began under Bush. They're standard Keynesian economics. Now, you can quarrel that you don't believe in Keynesian economics.
Well, you can also, you can use all of the long words that you wish, and believe me, I know all of them and then some. But what you're saying is all he's doing is copying what Bush did or continuing what Bush started. Isn't that your argument?
He's continuing standard Keynesian.
So in other words, you're saying the two wrongs make a right is what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that at all. The Keynesian calls for a reduction in interest rates and government spending on infrastructure.
Yes, but we've had experts on the show who say that these policies that you are referring to, John Keynes, are a failure. They will not work. You can't argue that by printing money you're going to save the economy, can you?
I think it's fair to argue whether one believes in the Keynesian thing, but to invoke it as something out of the Sinclair Lewis novel, I think that's unfair to him.
Well, why? Wait, excuse me. Pardon me, sir. The candidate who arises is a right-winger in this book. And in the first thing he does is quote, and I'm quoting now, "All finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank. Isn't that more or less 85% of what Obama has achieved?
Well, that they have taken the taking over of these banks has been done because the banks were about to go under. So it was a question.
Whoa! But there were banks that said they didn't want the government bailout money; they were forced to take it.
Understanding of that was that it was because if certain banks were found to have received it and certain were not, that it could stimulate a run on the ones that did receive the money.
Well, of course, that's a clever argument. But there are banks that say they didn't want the government money because it came with strings attached, meaning control. Now, the bailing out of AIG, even though that they got $300 billion last October, they blew through it. Now they're giving them another $150. What do you think about that? That's a good idea?
No. Just as Bernanke said the other day, if you listen to his entire period before the Senate, he actually stated, "I'm extremely angry." He actually used the word angry twice to describe his feelings about the AIG mess.
You mean he was angry, but he was going to do it anyway? That's a classic setup. When a guy is caught doing something, he says, "I really don't want to do this. I hate doing this, but I have to do it anyway." You don't believe that. You're an intelligent man.
It's because of the worry over the cast. The AIG apparently is such a big organization with so many counterparties that they feel trapped into having to do this, otherwise the ripple effect of it dying would be immense. Listen, I think the real issue here is, you know, Obama's an African American. You have a lot of animus toward them because you feel they aced you out.
Now you're falling back to the racist argument. And that's all you really have at the end of the day, which is anytime anyone criticizes this charlatan, this fraud, you're going to revert back to racism. It's not going to work with me. Maybe it will work with you because you harbor racist feelings. I don't.
He touches a raw nerve in your psyche where you felt unjust.
Now you're a psychiatrist, Steve. Now that you've lost the argument on the economic level, you're reverting to the standard liberal platitude of racism. I'm surprised at you, Stephen. You should know better than that. It doesn't fly anymore. That was used by Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson so much. That boy has cried wolf so many times, no one listens to him anymore, Steve. You should know better than that.
Your case, it's brought up all the time. You feel they...
Stephen, you know that you're the real racist. When have you last had a person of color to your house, Steve?
The issue. You feel they...
Steve, when did you last have a colored person to dinner, Steve?
You feel they aced you,
Steve,
out.
Steve, when did you last have a colored person to dinner, Steve? You're the white liberal racist. Don't try it on me, Bubba. So, you know, you talk about a specious argument. The man starts by trying to debunk Sinclair Lewis and my using Sinclair Lewis to make my point that Obama is following the program of a dictatorship. And then, of course, once he loses that argument, the caller, he reverts to the specious argument that any criticism of Obama is de facto racist. You can expect more of this. And, of course, this is what makes Obama doubly dangerous. Because in addition to being... Now, remember, he was the most liberal senator in American history. Now that he's president, he's far to the left of even his positions as a senator. Because he has almost absolute power. And as you well know, Lord Acton taught you, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Obama is an example of that theorem. He has absolute power because the Republican Party has become supine. The reason they have become supine is because they are a worthless bunch of dopes. They're as corrupt as the Democrats are. You want to comment on this? Fine. Phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Now, the proof is in the pudding. He's taking over the banks, the insurance companies, Wall Street, in more ways than one. But I made a prediction on the show yesterday that I'll repeat right now so that you can mark it down. Savage predicts a Reichstag fire-like event sometime within the next year or two in America that will have been conducted by the government and blamed upon subversive elements in order to permit a dictatorship, and a naked dictatorship to emerge in this country. If you think I'm making this up, you're right, I'm making it up. But I'm not making it up out of whole cloth, I'm making it up out of historical cloth. Rahm Emanuel is a very devious man. Rahm Emanuel has deep roots going back to dictatorial inclinations. You want me to open that one up? Would you like to discuss Rahm Emanuel and who he is? And what his background is and his father's background? His father was a member of the Irgun, in the early days of Israel, which I think is quite ironic when you think about it. Here you have the most anti-Israel administration in modern American history, perhaps since Eisenhower. And the chief of staff's name is Rahm Emanuel. He is from Israel, and his father fought with Meir Begin in the Irgun in the early days of the foundation of Israel. Some would call, some would term the Irgun a terrorist organization. They did horrible things. They blew up the King David Hotel, killing British soldiers. If they had any opponents within their own party, meaning Jews against Jews, they took the men that they caught, who they didn't approve, and they put their hands on the top of doors, and they closed doors on their fingers and broke their fingers. They were not nice guys. They were powerful, brutal, bloodthirsty revolutionaries. That's who created Israel. And that's how every country on earth has been created, by tough guys who are killers. There's not a country on earth that's been created by nice men. So let's not make this an exception. So now Rahm Emanuel grows up in the home of a Jewish revolutionary in Israel, and now he is the chief of staff to the president of the United States, who happens to stab Israel in the back as one of his first acts, through the hands of Hillary Clinton, who hoodwinked the Jews of New York, by the way, to get elected. She made herself look like someone who would support Israel. And the minute she was no longer needing them, she did what was necessary for the New World Order and the powers that be. The secret Saudi money that went into support Obama needs to be, you know, paid back. I mean, there's a reason that they supported Obama. The long and short of it is Rahm Emanuel was steeped and raised in politics of the most ruthless kind by his daddy. And if you think he's not trying to act out these policies, these methodologies, I believe you're wrong. For them to attack, for example, Rush Limbaugh head on in this manner indicates, A, how desperate they are, and B, how dictatorial they are. George Bush, for all of his flaws, and I was probably his most profound critic in the independent movement. For 7.5 years, I tried to steer this man back to the center, but it was almost impossible. He had veered so far to the left, it was a very difficult, daunting task. But you know what I did over the years. It was a very difficult job with George Bush. But for all of his flaws, George Bush never, ever singled out people in the media by name and put them on an enemies list. He never did that. Right now, they're doing it. And if you think Rush Limbaugh is the only one on the enemies list, you are mistaken. They don't need a fairness doctrine. All they need to do is scare off advertisers to the Rush Limbaugh show. All they need to do is scare off the owners of the companies that own the syndication company that syndicates Rush Limbaugh by saying, if you don't do this, that, or the other thing with him, if you don't rein in Rush Limbaugh and the others, we're going to do X, Y, and Z to your syndication. We're going to do X, Y, and Z to your corporation. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. If, on the other hand, you play ball with us, we'll make sure that your corporation gets benefits. For example, there's a story on my website that's not directly related but somewhat related of the Obama administration bailing out General Electric. Go to michaelsavage.com because it's a very important story. The Obama administration is fundamentally bailing out General Electric. Read the story. Why is it important? How does it relate to what I'm talking about? Right now it's on the left side. Obama's hidden bailout of General Electric by Timothy P. Carney, D.C. Examiner. It says General Electric's unmatched lobbying force has secured a tax increase or its equivalent in Obama's budget. Now, General Electric owns NBC. General Electric owns MSNBC. There are no two networks that are more owned by the government than those two, as you well know. Obama's camp. That's because Mr. Immelt, who runs General Electric, got the bailout, a $646 billion, $646 billion tax increase. Did they get the tax increase? Listen to the story. You have to read the whole story. While many companies hire lobbyists to win earmarks, GE's unmatched lobbying force has secured a tax increase or its equivalent in Obama's budget. Labeled climate revenues and totaling $646 billion over 8 years, this line item in Obama's budget has inspired confidence in GE Chief Executive Officer Jeff Immelt. Now, why would he want the Obama administration to do this? As Immelt put it, in a letter this week, he believes that the Obama administration will be a profitable financier and key partner. I'm quoting now. How does that work? Well, what does that mean? You'll have to read on. You will find out that GE is going to benefit from this. Immelt wrote this. The interaction between government and business will change forever. In a reset economy, the government will be a regulator and also an industry policy champion, a financier, and a key partner. In short, General Electric plans to get rich by being one of the government's closest partners, which it has always been thanks to its unmatched lobbying efforts. In other words, by attacking greenhouse gases, by forcing companies to pay greenhouse gas credits, and by forcing companies to trade these greenhouse gas credits, supporting Obama. Do you understand now why the Obama administration opposes any free market voice in the media? Now you understand how things work. There are other stories on my website that you shouldn't miss today. Tomorrow is a very important day in the history of the American family. Tomorrow, three rotten, stinking bums in black robes will hold the future of California's morality in their hands. Three ambivalent degenerates in black robes will decide whether or not to throw out the votes of 7 million Californians and rule whether or not there shall be a thing called homosexual marriage, which, as you well know, is not only an abomination to every religion on earth, but a shame to the family itself, because it's a fraud and a mockery of marriage. We have a man in this state named Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown, who used to be known as Moonbeam, has become the chief lobbyist for the homosexual mafia. Here is the man, Jerry Brown, who is the Attorney General of the state of California, whose job it is to uphold ballot initiatives after they are voted upon. He is now saying he wants the ballot initiative thrown out. Jerry Brown is saying drop dead to 7 million voters, and then he's going to come back and run for the governorship. After he's telling the voters to drop dead, he's going to run for the... How many gays can there be in the state of California? You would think that everybody in California is gay, but that's not the answer. The most powerful people in the state are gay. The most powerful financial forces in the state are run by gays. Start with Hollywood. And consequently, Jerry Brown does what his masters want him to do, just as any Twosome Newsome does what the powerful homosexual lobby wants him to do. Family values. You talk about traditional values. You talk about the sanctity of the ballot. You talk about go to the polls and vote like a schmuck so that a dictator like Jerry Brown can throw your vote in the garbage. He can turn it into toilet paper. What these people are doing, what these leftist fanatics are doing, is fomenting a civil war in this country. When it will start, I do not know. How it will start, I do not know, but I'll predict it will start. I believe there'll be 1,000 civil wars in this country before this is over. I believe there'll be 1,000 points of light, but in the wrong direction. I am not looking forward to this. But when people follow the rules and are shafted by Obama by seeing their deadbeat bum neighbors next door getting a bailout for their mortgage, when people follow the rules in California and go to the polling booth and they don't throw stink bombs or grenades to get their way, they do it peacefully at the ballot box, and one petty dictator throwback Neanderthal named Jerry Brown turns against the California voters and says, drop dead, I am owned by the homosexual mafia because they have more money and I want to win. Tell me if you think the people are going to take this sitting down. I don't think so. This is not good for democracy. This is not good for families. This is not good for children, but that's what happens when you have left-wing goon squads taking over the country. That's one man's opinion. I'll be back.
Savage.
Watching the emergence of a soft Marxism, I have determined it's a neo-Marxist regime running America. They called the Bushies neocons for years, and you accepted that, and that became a sneer. Neocon this, neocon that. I have tried to tell you that you can use language to your advantage. I've tried to empower you with language. Whenever you say Obama, you have to say Obama the neo-Marxist. You have to say the neo-Marxist Rahm Emanuel. You have to say the neo-Marxists like Barney Frank and Nancy Pelosi. You've got to start to use language to fight these people. I'm using whatever I have in my armamentarium, including literature. Now, I had an earlier caller who was shocked that I know Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here. I heard him. I'm sure he never heard anyone in talk radio refer to a literary work of any kind, because people don't generally read in talk radio. They're generally at a different from a different point of view, which is a non-book point of view, internet and this and that. But I think that you need to know some history and some literature to understand where we are at. Unfortunately, America doesn't have much of that in the media. We don't have much of many people who can do literature or history. I can't. So when I tell you to read It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis, and I'm going to make a jump on Amazon like I care, the man's been dead forever. It was about his fears of a dictatorship arising in America, a right-wing dictatorship. But much of what happened, I mean, this man who wrote this hated the Nazis. He hated Mussolini. He hated fascism. Rightly so. But what we have now is left-wing fascism emerging in America. And what they want to do now is globalize this virus. That's why Gordon Brown comes over here and says that we need to globalize and protect everyone. Global, global, global. Global New Deal, meaning you're going to bail out the bums in Hungary. You understand? I'm going to read you something from page 126 of the book of What Could Happen. Okay. Shall I read this? Shall I scare you? By joint resolution, with less than half an hour of debate, both houses of Congress rejected that demand before 3 p.m. on January 21st. Before 6, the president had proclaimed that a state of martial law existed during the present crisis, and more than 100 congressmen had been arrested by Minutemen on direct orders from the president. The congressmen who were hot-headed enough to resist were cynically charged with inciting to riot. They who went quietly were not charged at all. It was blandly explained to the agitated press by Lee Saracen that these latter quiet lads had been so threatened by irresponsible and seditious elements that they were merely being safeguarded. Saracen did not use the phrase protective arrest, which might have suggested things. To the veteran reporters, it was strange to see the titular Secretary of State, theoretically a person of such dignity and consequence that he could deal with the representatives of foreign powers, acting as press agent and yes man for the president. There were riots instantly all over Washington, all over America. The recalcitrant congressman had been penned in the district jail. Toward it, in the winter evening, marched a mob that was noisily mutinous toward the Windrip for whom so many of them had voted. Surrounding the jail behind machine guns, the rebels found a few regulars, many police and a horde of Minutemen. But I'm not going to read you the whole book. So you say, that can't happen here. That's impossible. Well, the book is called It Can't Happen Here. But guess what, folks? It is happening here. The gang has taken over America. If you think they're going to do everything overnight, you're crazy. They know you're stupid. They know you're distracted. And they know there's no better way to distract you than to scare you. So they scare you by shaking the economy up every day, telling you to be frightened. They scare you in every way about global warming in the midst of a blizzard. They scare your children every day about global warming in the midst of a blizzard. Every day it's a scare tactic, one scare tactic over another. And that's to keep you off base so you don't watch what they're really doing. They're pulling the wool over your eyes. Wisconsin John, welcome to the Savage Nation.
What a pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Savage. I believe dictator Obama is on the fast track to sink America so that it causes a worldwide tsunami economic effect, and thus it paves the way to set up the Antichrist. And I know a lot of people don't believe that.
Well, I'd rather not go into the Antichrist and stick only to the current economic problems that are being not solved but made worse by faulty thinking. I'd rather not talk about the Antichrist because it has no meaning to me. I mean, you know, then people are going to write you off as a complete nut. What is the Antichrist? What does it mean? What does it actually mean? Anyone can be an Antichrist. What's an Antichrist? The person you don't like? So let's not go there, please. I'd rather stay away from religiously charged phrases such as that. Okay? Ohio, Gary, welcome to the program. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, brother. Thanks, Doc, for taking my call, man, because you tell a story like It just, maybe it did. I wasn't around, but.
Well, I don't think it went on. No, I've heard people say cynically, there's nothing new under the sun, that you think this is something new. It really went on. It did not go on. No president in modern American history has ever printed so much money so fast and rewarded his cronies as quickly as Obama under the guise of economic recovery. No, it has never happened like this. Never. Never. The only time I've seen this happen is on an episode of The Sopranos when gangsters who owned a strip parlor got their fingers, their hooks into a guy who owned a big sporting goods store. They got him to gamble. Then they said, you owe us a certain amount of money from the gambling that you lost. We're going to take it out. You got 20% a week interest. Eventually, they took over the sporting goods store, emptied it out, and he wound up bankrupt. That's what they're doing to us. That's my opinion. It's exactly like that episode of The Sopranos. Now, what about the illegal alien and the cost of the illegal alien to this economy? Why is that sacred? They need the vote so much of the illegal that they won't even talk about their costs? Let's start with a simple fact. One out of three prisoners is an illegal alien who came here to rape, murder, drugs, you name it. One out of three prisoners is an illegal alien costing you $50,000 to $60,000 a year. You do the math. Why are they in our prisons? Why are they not deported? Well, for one, you've got the prison guard unions who want that. You've got the companies that provide food for the prisons. They want that. You've got various and sundry industries making billions of dollars a year on a prison population. So don't assume that that they're also patriotic in that system. But the bigger issue is, why is it that if they all come here to work, one out of three of them commit a serious enough felony to get caught? And by the way, that means they've gotten caught and convicted, which means many, many more of them are committing felonies and not getting caught and not getting convicted. I am the son of an immigrant. I know what it's like to arrive in this country with a suitcase and have nothing and work for everything. I have sympathy for those who have come here such long distances. I have no sympathy for criminals.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
If these times have shown us anything, it's that the major challenges we face are global. No matter where it starts, an economic crisis does not stop at the water's edge. It ripples across the world. Climate change does not honor passport control. Terrorism has no respect for borders. Modern communication instantly spans every continent. The new frontier is that there is no frontier.
Oh, shut up. Get this limey off my show. Send him back packing, this red bum. Here's a guy comes to the United States, a communist from Britain. They call him labor. A labor. A labor is soft communism. Comes to the United States. He gives a knighthood to Ted Kennedy, who left Mary Joe Kopechne dead in a creek in Massachusetts. And then he has the nerve to say that we need a global new deal, which means you have to bail out the deadbeats in England and everywhere else. That's what's going on in the world. It's the world upside down. The phone number here is 1-800-449-825. Don't act like you're not impressed. You know you're impressed. My deepest detractors are very impressed with this show, which is why they never, ever refer to me, because they know they lose every debate that they try. But here we are again. Sure, you voted for change, meaning you voted for anyone but George Bush. If the Democrats had put up Mickey Mouse, he would have won against George Bush. George Bush was such an imposter and fraud, and such an incompetent, such a bumbler, that Mickey Mouse running on the Democrat ticket could have beaten him. Of course, if the Republicans had run Romney would have won against Obama by 15 points. But the Republicans withdrew Romney for obvious reasons. They knew what they had done to the economy. They knew what they had done to the economy. And they knew that there'd be a crash after Bush left. I warned you 6 months ago. I warned you 6 months ago that Bush isn't finished yet. And every month it got worse. Do you remember? He kept making it worse. $50 billion to Africa for AIDS? Where'd that money go? Who got the $50 billion in Africa? You think the AIDS patients got it? You're mistaken. No, they didn't get it. It was a payoff that went to the drug companies that provide AIDS medication to some extent. It was a way of buying favor with the international community, i.e. the European socialists, saying, if I give $50 billion to Africa, would you agree not to try me and Dick Cheney for war crimes in The Hague after we're out of office? So in other words, that's what happened there. So they people said, all right, enough is enough. So if Romney knew that if he had run and win, he would be inheriting this disaster. And the Republicans didn't want the blame for it anymore. They had 8 good years. They had 8 wonderful years of sacking the Treasury. And so they figured now it's time for the Democrats to have it for 8 years, because that's the way the phony two-party system works. 8 years Clinton, 8 years Bush, 8 years Obama, and then there's Mush. The phone number here is 1-800-44-23-24 years of Clinton, Bush, and Obama. You think there's going to be a country? By the way, I remind you, you know, many of you think that because you have a gun somewhere in your house that you're a free man. You're mistaken. The gun is basically good for one thing only. It's actually good for 2 things only. The good that the government will permit. And maybe you can use that gun to protect yourself, and I say maybe, against a break-in by a burglar. I'm not even sure that it's good for that. So I would say the government wants you to have your gun because they know that it's good, maybe in 25 to 30% of the time, to protect you and your family against a break-in. But it's not good for what you think it is. You're never going to rise up against an illegitimate regime. It'll never happen. It will never happen. Make no mistake about it. Bill Clinton destroyed the militia movement in this country, if you remember. Remember there were militias? There were white militias, black militias. There were gay militias. There were Asian militias. There were Hispanic militias. You don't remember that? There were mixed militias. That was a big thing during the years of the Clintons. Remember what Bill Clinton did to the militias? He destroyed them. I'm giving you a little pocket history of America. George Bush then spent 8 years destroying the conservative movement. He took it apart at the joints. He destroyed anybody who stood in his way. He did it quietly, but he destroyed the conservative movement. There is no conservative movement per se. There are conservatives, but no movement. On the Republican side, there are no conservatives to speak of. There are a few congressmen who are great, like Stephen King. There are a few senators who are great, and I've named them on this show, but they're a handful. By and large, though, the Republican Party is a Democrat light party, it's been called, whatever you want to call them. It's a one-party system. You look at the thousands of earmarks in Obama's spending bill that's coming up, most of them are Republican earmarks. What does that tell you? It tells you it's a charade, it's a fraud. So there it is. That's all there is to it. And I have nothing more to add to this. I have read to you over the last 2 days from It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis. And I challenge anyone listening to this show to tell me of another talk show in the United States of America that could do so, meaning bring up a literary work such as this, and make it relevant to our time. And I can do that with the Bible. I can do it with a piece of literature. I can do it with a movie. I can bring them all down to the politics of the day or the news of the day, trying to make my point. Now, it is true that this is a very, very important show to the millions of loyal listeners. But you can see what they're doing now. They're going after Rush Limbaugh because he has the largest audience. He has a big day part. He does a good job for what he does. I mean, I do it differently, so he and I don't do it the same way. So they're going after the number one target in conservative talk radio. They know that they can't pass a fairness doctrine. They know that the people would go crazy if they did that. So instead of doing that, the son of Mr. Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel, the son of one of the Irgun members of Israel, Rahm Emanuel, uses the terror tactics that were used in Israel in the early days to destroy the opposition. They use many tactics, but all of them are fundamentally terroristic. And if you think it's not terroristic of a government to attack someone in the media who criticizes them, then look at what Chavez is doing in Venezuela. There's no difference between what Chavez is doing in Venezuela and what Rahm Emanuel is doing here in America. The only difference is by degree. Remember, Chavez didn't do this overnight. Chavez didn't come to power and immediately seize the movie industries and the television industries and the radio. He didn't do that. Remember, it took him years to do that. Chavez took years to do what Obama's doing in a few months. So in some ways, Obama is even more of a terrorist than Chavez is. That's how I see it. It's one man's opinion. Do you think I'm being too extremist? I don't. I think I'm being a realist. That's how I see this. I see no opposition. And I'd like to ask you what you think. So I'll open up the callers here on the Savage Nation when I come back. Again, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Or if this story bores you, if the thought of a dictatorship taking over America bores you, we can talk about rotten eggs being the new Viagra. I'll be right back.
Savage.
And today, having talked to him last night, I want to announce, awarded by Her Majesty the Queen, on behalf of the British people, an honorary knighthood for Sir Edward Kennedy.
Sir Edward Kennedy, perhaps one of the greatest scoundrels in the history of the U.S. Senate. Now, I know he has brain cancer and you're supposed to now whitewash the man's past. How can you whitewash the man's past? Put aside his extreme ultra-liberal policies, which I detest. He's entitled to them. How about leaving a young lady to die in Chappaquiddick Creek? How does that sit with you liberals? How does that sit with you feminists? Doesn't that bother you? Isn't that an embarrassment? But then what is England anyway today? What does a knighthood mean? They give it to half the gangbangers in England who can strum a guitar. Well, what does a knighthood mean? Her Majesty the Queen. What does she mean? Who's Her Majesty the Queen? Don't get me started on royalty. I don't really have a soft spot for royals. I never did. I'm an anti-royalist. I have no feeling for the royal family. I think they should all be forced to work, particularly that dimwit with big ears who never worked a day in his life, that moron. A knighthood, Sir Edward Kennedy. Wow. Look how low England has fallen. You got a soft communist comes over here asking with the begging cup for a global new deal, and on top of it all, he kisses the butt of the entire radical left establishment by giving a knighthood to Sir Edward Kennedy. Of all the senators, I can't think of someone who doesn't deserve it more than him. I mean, it's like saying Sir Dennis Kucinich. It's like granting a knighthood to Barney Frank. Sir Barney Frank for running a brothel in his apartment when he was a young congressman. We're granting him a knighthood because it's in fitting with the English social scene today. By the way, before I take your calls on the Savage Nation, I got to tell you about an interesting sleeper movie I saw on TV last night by accident. It's called The Beautiful Country. I think it's The or This Beautiful Country. It was an absolute sleeper with Nick Nolte done in 2004. I saw it on cable. First, it's very slow moving. It's the saga of a poor half Vietnamese, half American boy who is shunned by the Vietnamese, treated like dirt because he's biracial. And the Vietnamese spit on him. I mean, you don't even know what goes on over there. You all think everyone's so nice. But they treat him less than a dog. And he lives like a beaten dog over there in Vietnam. Nobody wants to play with him because they're racist and they don't like a half-Caucasian person, unlike Americans, who are the most tolerant people on the planet. Most places on Earth are extremely racist. So they treat him like dirt. And it's his saga of leaving Vietnam and coming over as a boat person, I can't fill in all the details, to find his father, who we never met, who was an American soldier. He only has a picture of him when he was a young man standing in Saigon, and he hears about an address somewhere in Texas. And it's about the Vietnamese-American actor's fabulous in this, and it's the boat journey, and the sea captain on this rusty old freighter is played by Tim Roth in one of his best roles, by the way. For a while, you do a double take. You can't believe it's Tim Roth. And him getting here and being exploited by the Chinese in the Chinese restaurants in New York, and finally getting to see Nick Nolte, who's working as a ranch hand way out in the boonies in Texas, I'm not going to give away what happens because it's you got to watch the whole movie. What got to me was is the passage over. I mean, I know it was done to create sympathy for immigrants. I understand that. But I am an immigrant son with sympathy for immigrants. So don't get me wrong on that. And it shows how they're exploited, how they save money. And then when they get on the boat, how the vicious guy, the slave trader in essence, says to them, okay, it's $8,000, not $2,000. And you're going to work it off for as many years as it takes in New York. And, you know, the girl he's traveling with is turned into a prostitute. And he has a little brother with him, a half-brother, who it's so sad when the brother dies on the boat, the little boy, who is the most beautiful little boy I've seen in years in the movies, dies and he has to throw him overboard in cardboard. Gee, I mean, you can rip your guts out. You say, well, all right, it happened. I know that when my ancestors came over here, people died on those hellhole boats as well from Europe. They traveled in steerage. They didn't travel upstairs in cabins. Many of them died on the trip over. So it's a repetition of the history of America, whether it be the English, the Irish, the Jews, the Italians, the Germans, the Poles, whoever came over, the Europeans, all went through the same thing on hellish trips across the Atlantic with people dying in the holds and coming here with next to nothing and trying to live the American dream. And I understand that. And it makes you understand that in a new way. But having said that, I'm still against illegal immigration because the lifeboat is full and we're all sinking. I have warned you for 8 years. Actually, for 15 years, I started in talk radio in 1994. I have warned you since 1994 that although I am an immigrant son, and although I have sympathy for all of the poor and wretched of the earth who want to come to America for the freedoms that are here, we can't afford them. The social costs are overwhelming, and I warned that they would eventually bankrupt the country. Now you say, well, they're not the reason. It's the gangsters of Wall Street. No, well, they're part of the reason. Of course the gangsters of Wall Street are responsible. Of course the two parties are raping the Treasury. And of course the illegals are costing us billions upon billions of dollars a month. Go to the hospitals. They're closing across America. New York City lost two hospitals in Queens or is about to lose them. Here in the border states, hospitals are closing. They can't afford to treat the illegals for nothing. Somebody has to pay for this. Why do you think your schools have degenerated? Because too much of the money is spent on English as a second language, for example. And so the basics are not being taught in English. A good portion of the budget is going to teach illegal aliens how to speak English. That's if they're willing to learn it to begin with. So the schools are suffering. The hospitals are suffering. You're suffering. I'm suffering. We're all suffering. All aboard. The movie, again, is called, I think it is called This Wonderful Country. It stars a Vietnamese actor who I don't remember his name, but I know Nick Nolte, who I used to like as an actor and I haven't seen in years in any part, really plays an amazing role. He's only in it for about 5 minutes toward the end of the movie as the father that, you know, the guy's father who he hasn't seen. It's really a touch. The Beautiful Country. It's a movie that you may want to watch. I mean, your kids might watch it with you, but I think they'll walk out because it's too long and too, you have to be an adult and have, you know, suffered somewhat in life and understand suffering and understand what it is family, what family is. If you don't have a family, this movie isn't going to mean anything to you. Because there's one thing that can be said about the Vietnamese people is their family bond. It is so powerful. The connections are so strong. It's a beautiful thing to watch. And I guess one of the most touching scenes is when he leaves his poor mother because of something occurs. He has to flee the country. It's so heartbreaking to see her rip. She's a poor servant in a rich Vietnamese woman's house who steps on her like a worm, treats her like garbage. You don't know what treatment is. You know, that's the second beautiful part about this movie is to show you virtually the lack of human rights in so many other countries of the world, particularly in Asia. They treat each other like garbage. There's no such thing as human rights in those countries. And you talk about racism. Are you kidding me? You know, you say this country's racist. This country is the least racist country on planet Earth. We do have a half-black president, by the way. It's the least racist country on Earth. It was white people who elected Obama, by the way. So you look at this movie and you start to see, my God, what a great country we live in. And, of course, that's why I recommend the movie, and I think you ought to watch it. But let us get back to the issues at hand. Gordon Brown, the British socialist slash communist, comes here with a begging cup. and says it's a global new deal, you see, that we need for prosperity, that we have to bail him out and his failed policies. And then he buys off the socialist liberal establishment in America by granting an honorary knighthood to Sir Edward Kennedy. It doesn't get lower than this, or does it?
Savage.
I told her that I was a flop with chicks. I've been this way since 1956. She looked at my palm and she made a magic sign. She said, what you need is love potion number 9.
It's Rock and Roll Wednesday on the Savage Nation. I need to lighten it up a little bit because there's only so much anybody can take. I may be an ensign on a hill, but there's only so much light in any lighthouse, you know what I'm saying? For it is a rebellious people, lying children, children that refuse to hear the teaching of the Lord, that say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy delusions. So the Bible warned us about men like Obama, the glib. They warned us about men who would speak unto us smooth things and prophesy delusions. Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. Because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perverseness. Well, that doesn't apply yet. He's a good family man. But let us go back to that, that say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things. Speak unto us smooth things, prophesy delusions. There's no question that Obama is a smooth operator. But if you actually analyze what he is doing and his rhetoric, it's as though Jesse Jackson has won for the presidency, only without the anger and the rage. Period. End of story. It's as though Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton has become president without the anger and without the rage. That's all. That's all. So this is what you have. This is the change you wanted. Now you have it. WOR in New York, Christina, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, I just have a quick question, and I wanted to know if you think that his control is so extensive that at his will, he'll turn the economy around, that he's letting it go down and down and down until it gets to a certain point, and then he'll just snap his fingers and everybody falls in line.
I don't know what you mean by that. What do you mean he has the power? What power does he have? He can't make the stock market go up and down.
I know, but I'm saying...
I mean, he's been driving the market down by talking doom and gloom. Then he said, go buy stocks, so they went up. I mean, what's the stock market? I mean, the stock market's an emotional reactor as much as anything else.
So what I'm saying is, do you think that at a certain point, when it benefits him, he decides to now change the message? It's time to rally around him. And he's then seen...
Well, what do you mean? Change the message how? In what regard?
He's a downer every time he gets on TV. He's not rallying anybody around anything.
Well, he's used fear to get the people behind him. There's no question. He's a fearmonger. The man ran on hope and change, and his man has used fear and scare tactics. We understand that. They're using doom and gloom and fear tactics, you know, in public to frighten people into rallying behind them. So what are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that possibly at a certain point he decides that it's time to change that message and everybody follows him. Or do you think enough people have wised up now to see what's going on?
Well, it's hard to say who's wised up. I don't know who, you know, the polls are up and down. Last week they said the polls showed that, according to Gallup, which is certainly more reliable than the Wall Street Journal poll, the Wall Street Journal, as you well know, is a lockstep behind Obama no matter what they say. It's owned by Murdoch. Murdoch's currying favor with Obama left and right. Murdoch's a Machiavellian media magnate who understands who he has to curry favor with, and he's in real trouble. He needs as many tax benefits and bailouts as he can possibly get. So, of course, his polls are showing Obama's popular, but last week there was a poll from Gallup, which is far more reliable, and by no means is it a conservative poll. The Gallup poll showed that Obama had a lower popularity after 1 month than did George Bush, for example.
I know. So what?
How did that suddenly turn around in 1 week? Because it's a fake poll by the Wall Street Journal. So I really don't know whether the people are wising up to him or not. I really don't know. I don't have an answer to that, Christina.
I know. I'm looking for insight because I listen to you almost every single day while I'm cooking dinner here in New Jersey. And you're on target with absolutely everything, but I do
have
to
That's right, because I speak the way most people who have brains talk in New Jersey. In other words, if you talk to people behind a closed door about what you really think, whether they be women friends or men in your life, they're all speaking directly to you. They're not masking anything. And when you listen to me on the radio, it feels as though you're talking to somebody who you know.
You do. You're cooking dinner with me.
There you go. Well, as long as I'm a home companion, that's all that matters. Thanks for the call. A lot of people do. That's okay. I'm everyone's friend. Even those who don't like me find me familiar already by now. I'm a part of their life, a part of their mental geography. 15 years you get to people, and they start to either, first they hate you, and then they say, wait a minute, the guy's making more sense. I actually like him. By the way, I got a copy of the book because I'm flying out to this new location on Friday. I'm in the midst of moving. I mean, the things are a mess. You have to go through photographs and guns and ammo and dogs and dog toys and underwear and socks and pictures and compasses and radios. You don't know what to take and what to leave. It's just like leaving the old country. Even though I'm only going, it's like a back and forth job, but I my head is spinning. The biggest challenge I had this week was the gun thing. I had to go into my gun cabinet. I had to get our guns out and clean in 10 years. I became like an Eddie in a shop, you know what I mean, with the gun rod. It was amazing. It's a nice feeling to go into the AR, the Ruger Mini 14 that's still legal, get out the dirt. I mean, I shot some handguns about a month ago. The guy says to me, you don't have to clean them. I had never heard that, but I got lazy in my old age. I didn't clean them. I cleaned them. They were full of dirt. I said, what do you tell me not to clean them for? I said, what are you listening to a guy who wants to sell you another gun for? It's like a used car dealer telling you don't have to change the oil in a car. But I got everything tidied up now. All of my affairs are in order, so to speak. It's like moving is like dying, in a way. That's what you don't like about it. It's like you realize all of the loose ends, they're not, you know, you got to connect them up. That's a good thing. It makes you look through things and clean up. But me all having a studio built for myself in another part of the country in a secret location, as I talk every day, I'm going crazy from this. It's an amazing thing I got to tell you about. It's like an amazing story. First, I thought that there'd be an ISDN line available. And then after I purchased the property, I was told by the company, no, there's no ISDN. I almost had a heart attack. I said, oh, my God. So then I was told we can use MPLS service. So they've put in the MPLS. Don't ask what has been going on. They got in there, and then the house was built 10 years ago. There was a pipe under the ground that the people who built the house were very smart. And they had all the phone wires coming in one pipe, but the builder was so smart, the architect and builder, the owner, that they put a second pipe on the ground from the street all the way to the house that was left blank for future usage, for phone cables and, you know, whatever. So I said, oh, my God, what good news that is, because the other thing had 8 lines going in it. So they were going to run a line from the street. They found out that the thing had been left open for all these 10 years, and there was, like, water in the line. And the pull line broke, trying to pull the lines through. I said, oh, my God, that was yesterday. Any wonder I'm having, like, a nervous breakdown. But listen to how clever these phone people are. The technology has gotten so far. So I said, now that your pull line is broken, what are you going to do? They said, don't worry, we have a technique using compressed air. So what? They blow an air jet through the pipe, and they blew out 5 gallons of water from the house. Thank God they blew it from the house out to the street instead of into the house. Then, to get the pull line back into the house, they put a rag on the end of a pull line and blow it the other way into the house with compressed air. I mean, you got to be impressed with this, right? So then they pull the wires in and they do a test, and it's got static on the line. That was last night as I went to sleep. And now I wake up and they're running a test on the new line, and it's not staticky. It is staticky. What do I know there? I'm going to go crazy by the time I get there. And I hope that when I get there and everything's fine, on Monday I can get back on the air with a whole new line, a whole new show. But I'm going to basically go back and forth. I'm not going to be in any one place for any long period of studio that I have somewhere in America that I move around in. And for obvious reasons, because I can't predict where I'll be or when, which I like. I enjoy that very much. But technology today is so wonderful. Just to think about the technology. When I started in radio, to spend one more minute on this, there was no internet per se. I mean, it was internet, but it was not really as pervasive as it was a few years later. I had to get newspapers and magazines, and we had a thing called, wires, like, you know, AP wires that came down. And you were basically a victim of the wire services only. So your view of the news was completely shaped and controlled by a few outlets. And look what's happened now with the internet, where you can go, anyone can go on and get the news in 2 seconds. So you say, well, why is radio still popular? If the average person cooking dinner can go to a computer and go on to any website they want and in 5 seconds get all the headlines, and the newspapers are going bankrupt, why is talk radio still booming? Why is talk radio such a force that the president of the United States would seek to attack Rush Limbaugh and, frankly, others in talk radio, if not directly, then indirectly? Why? Why are we still such a viable force if the newspapers have died? That's because we are providing an outlet for a voice that has been suppressed by the American media and has now been virtually silenced by the neo-Marxist regime of Obama. I'll be right back. Savage. This Runaway by Del Shannon. That's when America was great. The throne was thick and the women were straight. Look what's happening. All these women with shaved heads. It looks like Bergen Belsen half the women. Why was that with the shaved head? I don't get it. Well, why are they walking around with shaved heads? That's stylish? Everyone, leave me alone. I'm talking to myself. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. When the chrome was thick, and the women were straight. That's what this show is dedicated to, the Savage Nation. Hey, play Ray Charles, I Got a Woman. And by the way, I will give out a free copy of Psychological Nudity to the first caller in the next 5 minutes from KGIL in Los Angeles.
I got a woman, way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money.
He had his day. I'm not going to. I don't want to hear it. How about Bobby Day? I want to hear Bobby Day over and over. I like that. There's a story that goes with it. Let me hear over and over.
Da-da-da. Went to a dance the other night.
Come on.
Everybody went
That's
stag.
The build up.
I said over and over and over again. This dance is gonna be a drag. I said over and over and over again. This dance is gonna be a drag. I said over and over and over.
That was a very big song when I was a wee lad up in the Catskill Mountains. And a certain famous comedian today made his first appearance at this hotel, one of his earliest professional appearances. And he was such a bust that the owner came out. I told the story before, but the owner came out of the hotel. He was an ex-boxer, the owner of the hotel. One of those old-time Jewish tough guys, grew up in the streets. And he had a little, you know, hotel up there. But he ran it like a little dictatorship. You didn't drop a piece of silverware, he didn't whack you around. I mean, it was a crazy place. If someone took an extra extra pack of sugar back to the bunk, he caught you, give you a beating. It was a terrible location, but people liked the hotel. So anyway, this comedian comes up there. He opens and no one laughs, not one laugh in the casino. So the next day, the owner, true to form, throws him out. All right, get out of here. You're a flop. Now, he's a big guy now, huge. So as he's leaving, this comedian, who today is famous, he's a young guy then, 20. He comes out to the pool with a cardboard suitcase with his entire life possessions to say goodbye to the other staff, the waiters, the busboys, whoever. And, you know, goodbye. And he's only there one night, but he was a nice guy standing around the pool. Some of the nasty guys sneak up behind him and they throw him in the pool. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, him looking up from the pool with his suitcase blew open in the water and all of his underwear's floating around and he's soaked, but he's not angry and he's not depressed or he's not showing it. Instead, he's laughing back at them like it's all a big joke on them. In other words, I looked at this guy. I was like a kid, 15. I looked at this guy who had just been humiliated or they attempted to humiliate him. Instead of freaking out like a girl and screaming and getting, you know, a hissy fit, this guy who then became big, I knew he was going to be a huge success one day. Why? Because his spirit was so strong that they couldn't break it. They threw him in the pool. everything, life possessions floating around, but he looked up at them and laughed at them. And sure enough, years later, he did become a very big comedian. And I'm not going to mention it's unimportant who he is. The important thing is the will. My father ridiculed me through my entire childhood. You don't have willpower. You know, I didn't even know what willpower was, but he told me I didn't have it. I said, Dad, I don't know what it, that's what I mean. You don't have, what do you mean willpower? You need willpower. I don't know what he was talking about. You don't have willpower. I almost cried. I didn't know what it was. Tell me what it is so I can get it. How do you get willpower? You don't have willpower. In other words, he was afraid that his son, his number one son, man-child in the promised land, who had to carry the banner of the immigrant family to the generation, to where I'm at today, didn't have the drive necessary to do it. He was afraid I was going to become an American wimp, in other words, from the soft life here compared to what he had had. Well, actually, he was right. I mean, I resented it as I got older and understood what he was saying. I got mad at him, and we had a lot of fights. We weren't on good terms when I left New York, and he died. I never saw him again. And we were never on good terms after that. We locked horns, and we were really angry at each other, and we never got a chance to say, hey, you did a good job or whatever. Neither of us did. But as it turns out, my tenacity is what's given me everything in life. Not just my tenacity. People with tenacity who don't get anywhere either. I'm lucky enough to have a great family. And I've told you that God is a very big part of all of this. I mean, when things don't go the way you want to go, you have to pray and pray and pray and pray and pray. And your prayers will sometimes, if you are fortunate enough, be answered. So it's a conglomerate of things. But the point I'm making is that without that drive, without that willpower, without that tenacity, all the rest of it really doesn't matter. So in a way, my father was 100% right. It really was willpower. So I look back and he was saying, you don't have willpower. I could hear his voice to this day ridiculing me. You need willpower. He understood as an immigrant. I told you a story earlier of the movie I saw, This Beautiful Country, about a half Vietnamese, half American immigrant who comes over as a boat person. Look at the stories about the willpower of that immigrant who has the guts to flee his own country, to pay a slave trader, to put up with the boat, to work as a busboy in a dirty little restaurant in order to get a toehold in America. Is that not willpower, the people who have the guts to leave their country? So, of course, I have eyes and ears and I have sympathy for the poor of America, the immigrant, the Mexican, the Guatemalan, the El Salvadoran, the Nicaraguan. I see them. I'm not blind. I understand what tenacity is and what guts they had to get here and how hard many of them work. But the lifeboat is full, as I said to you. Moreover, if the person is working for 10 or 15 bucks an hour, there is someone or others in the family who are not working at all who are living off the fat of the land. There is no fat anymore. It's over. And I've been warning about this for so many years. I knew that eventually it would bust out the schools and the hospitals, and it has, amongst other institutions of our society. So that's a long way of saying that it is willpower, and you shouldn't lose your will nor your power. Because although the neo-Marxists right now under Rahm Emanuel and Obama seem to have it all, they seem to have everything, the whole ball of wax, and they seem to have total power and total control, they don't. It's an illusion. It's an illusion created by the newspapers, the dying newspapers at that. It's an illusion created by the ossified creeps in the old mainstream media. Meet the Press invited me on for this Sunday. They sent me a message to my producer. Would Michael Savage like to go on Meet the Press and talk about Rush Limbaugh? I don't know, whatever else. So I sent them back a message which said, if Bob Schieffer will agree to meet the Savage Nation, I will agree to go and meet the Press. We didn't hear back from them. But I'm giving an example because of these front men for the neo-Marxist regime that we currently have. That's why you have all the power. Don't assume that they know what they're talking about. Most of them don't know what they're talking about. They're very glib. They're very able in describing what they think is reality, but it isn't reality. Your reality is your reality. Remember what the bedrock of a society is. It is built upon the family, man plus woman plus children. That's the brick of every society is a family. Every society on earth understands that. We're living in this unbrave new world where the gays have tried to subvert the very brick of civilization itself and destroy it, blow it up with the fraud called gay marriage. And from every level, the family is under attack. At every level of society, from every citadel, there are bricks raining down upon the poor nuclear family. And I advise you, keep the faith, baby, to use an old phrase of the 60s and turn it back upon them. Keep the faith, baby. And of course, by all means, remember the key phrase, will, power. With the will, you have the power. There are more of us than there are them. Willpower, my friends.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown came to the United States to bring his particular brand of British socialism to our country. Today he had the nerve to go before a joint session of Congress and sanctimoniously called for a global New Deal. Play the clip.
It was American visionaries who, over a half a century ago, coming out of the deepest of depressions and the worst of wars, produced the boldest of plans for global economic cooperation.
Oh, my God.
They recognized that prosperity was indivisible. They concluded that to be sustained, it had to be shared.
Well, sounds like more neo-Marxist liberalism to me.
Ours, too, is a time for renewal, for a plan for tackling recession and building for the future. Every continent playing their part in a global New Deal, a plan for prosperity that can benefit us all.
How did it come to this? The New Deal, of course, was the set of socialist programs that President FDR imposed on the United States in the 1930s. Well, apparently the New Deal has returned, but this time in more virulent form. The virus has mutated. This time, it's gone global. It's a global epidemic of socialism. At least Roosevelt never poured trillions of taxpayer dollars into the banks to keep them afloat and pay off his cronies. But that's exactly what King Obama is attempting to do and doing. And Prime Minister Gordon Brown wants Obama to go further than that. The global New Deal that Obama and Brown want isn't just about banks. Brown and Obama want a global stimulus. It seems they want all the countries of the world to get a bailout. Brown wants all the nations to work together to help the economy, which means the taxpaying American will have to support Romanians. This is code for a one-world socialist economic dictatorship. Obama and Brown want to use this emergency situation to bring the U.S. under even greater domination of the global economic cabal. And that's not all. Brown also demanded international economic cooperation on global warming, even though it doesn't exist. Just as the East Coast of the United States is in the midst of an unprecedented blizzard, Obama and Brown are trying to put over a snow job. They're using environmental radical fear tactics to further socialize America. Of course, Gordon Brown is not the first British prime minister to address a joint session of Congress. Just 3 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor in World War II, Winston Churchill spoke before Congress. His message was quite different. He spoke in dark times as well. But instead of turning to the idol of socialism, he turned to God. Listen to what Churchill said.
We are the masters of our fate. That the task which has been set us is not above our strength, that its pangs and toils are not beyond our endurance. As long as we have faith in our cause and an unconquerable willpower, salvation will not be denied us. In the words of the psalmist, he shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord.
Amazing words. I'll read them again. We are the masters of our fate, that the task which has been set upon us is not above our strength. that its pangs and toils are not beyond endurance. As long as we have faith in our cause and an unconquerable willpower, salvation will not be denied. In the words of the psalmist, he shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord. But the socialists of today have rejected God. Instead, they bow down to the altar of Marxism. And for those who choose maimon over God, there can be no salvation. There can be no stimulus. The New Deal is no deal. Gordon Brown is a socialist. Winston Churchill was a conservative. Churchill wanted England and America to move forward into the broad, sunlit uplands of freedom. But since Churchill's time, England has gone from being the greatest power in the world to being a second-rate socialist enclave for radical Muslims. That is the path that Gordon Brown wants the U.S. to follow, and Obama is very, very happy to comply. Obama's economic plan is targeting the successful and rewarding the failures, and it now seems that small businesses will be pushed out in favor of big government. Joining us now is Wayne Allen Root, who says Obama is starting an economic war against the private sector.
Thank you, Michael. Small business is the economic engine of America. Small business has created a majority of the jobs in this country. We create over 75% of all new jobs in this country, and we pay most of the taxes. Americans who earn over $200,000 a year pay 60% of all federal income taxes, and almost every one of those high earners are small business owners, entrepreneurs, or self-employed. I call them private sector taxpayers. But our new president, Barack Obama, doesn't care about those taxpayers. We are persona non grata to Mr. Obama. In Obama's caste system, we are the untouchables. Obama only cares about unions, government employee unions, teachers unions, auto unions. But we aren't just ignored as small business owners or self-employed Americans. We aren't just unloved by Obama and his friends. We are despised. We are targeted. We are discriminated against. Obama has declared war on small business and the private sector. Now, I'd like to give you some insight into the mindset of Barack Obama and his liberal tax and spend friends.
Mm-hmm.
No one in American politics better understands his hatred of successful people, his desire to destroy small business people and high-income earners, private sector taxpayers. No one understands it better than me, because I was his college classmate, Columbia University, class of 1983. Flashback to my political science class, 1981, at Columbia University, in a gigantic theater in the round with high ceilings that echoed. And a student burst into the back door of the classroom, out of breath, and screamed to the 250 students sitting in that theater in the round, "Reagan has been shot! They've assassinated the president!" And the response from my classmates, extreme left-wing radical classmates, joy, cheer, celebration. My classmates hugged, cheered, high-fived, whooped, and screamed, "Reagan is dead! Yes!"
Unbelievable.
I got sick to my stomach. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the people now running our country. My classmates wound up populating three fields: the media, politics, and law. And they all hate the same groups. They hate entrepreneurs, they hate small business, they hate capitalism and capitalists, they hate politicians who champion capitalism and free enterprise, and they hate anyone that's self-made, because they're not. They showed their true colors that day, celebrating the death of a capitalist hero and a conservative free market politician that simply stood for lower taxes and limited government. Ronald Reagan was my hero. I loved Ronald Reagan. I still love Ronald Reagan. And these people rooted for his death.
This is unbelievable to me.
These are the people that now run our media. These are the people that now run our country. These are the people that populate the Obama administration. None of them are self-made. They're angry, bitter, and resentful of the success of anyone who is self-made. They hold a lifelong vendetta, and their goal is to damage or destroy self-made and self-employed Americans. They want to tax us to death. They want to punish us. They want to take away our economic freedom. They want to purge self-made entrepreneurs and unabashed capitalists from society. These are the people, Obama's people, that work for big government, for big unions, for big corporate bureaucracies, and for community activist groups. They hate the fact, they are bitter and resentful of the fact, that we work for ourselves, that we are courageous risk-takers who are rewarded by capitalism for our risks. They hate the fact that because we take those big risks, we make more money than they do. They can't stand our success. They can't stand our wealth. They can't stand our economic freedom. And they can't stand the fact, most importantly, that we are our own bosses. They want us to be beholden to government. They want to control our lives. They want us to be punished. They want to regulate us to death. And they want to use our tax money to pay for their big government jobs.
I'm sick of this.
They want to use our money for their social engineering plans to end what they call inequality and racism, to redistribute our wealth. I call it to bribe their voters. You know, what we really should call Barack's book is The Audacity of Class Warfare. Obama wins the Triple Crown by discriminating against us. He gets to punish us for the audacity of actually believing capitalism works, of actually proving capitalism works, for the audacity of making more money and creating more jobs than any liberal could ever do, things he couldn't do. He gets to punish us, and him and his friends feel good about it. Number two, he gets to use our tax money to pay for his programs, his bribes, his jobs for people that expect government to take care of them from cradle to grave. And number three, by taxing us to death, he deprives us of the money that we need to fund his political opponents. If Obama wants to raise taxes, then let him raise it equally on everyone. But raising it on only one group that makes more than $200,000 a year, or one group, small business, is discriminatory. I'm Wayne Allen Root, and you can reach me at rootforamerica.com.
Thanks, Wayne. Without small businesses, this country will not be America. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
This is Michael Savage, and here's what I've been talking about today. I've been invited on Face the Nation. Should I go on? Well, I sent them back a note. And they said they want me to go on and talk about Rush Limbaugh and the Republican Party. You know what they're going to do. So I said to them, I'll tell you what, I'll go on Face the Marxist Nation if Bob Schieffer, their front man, their spokesmouth, will go on and face the Savage Nation. Haven't heard from them. By the way, I've never read of such a vicious attack being launched by a government against someone in the media as I now see by the Obamaites, the gangsters in the Obama regime against Rush Limbaugh. The only other country where I see this occurring is in Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. And you think that this is a fair game? It's never been done in American history. Obama is being run with a gang. The gang is run by Rahm Emanuel, Paul Begalia, and Obama. You have a gang running America, not an administration. This is not even a regime. It's a gang. We also talked about Sir Ted. Sir Ted? Among the things that so-called British Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced in a speech before Congress today was that Ted Kennedy, of all people, will receive an honorary knighthood. Do you think Kennedy deserves a knighthood? For what? For his destruction of America's borders? For his constant attempts to remove guns from the hands of private citizens? For his attempts to impose socialized medicine on America? Or do you think it's for his great gold medal swimming ability, as demonstrated at Chappaquiddick, where he left a young woman to die? Right now, what we have is a dictatorship run by a gang. It's a gang under Obama, although I think he's the front man. I think that soon they're going to realize that he's more intelligent than they originally thought, and they're going to find out that they're going to be left out in the cold. But that's going to take a little while before the Rahm Emanuel gang realizes that Obama has outsmarted them and he's not just their front man. There is only one other country on earth that I know of that is currently conducting a campaign against the media that criticizes the regime, and that is Hugo Chavez's dictatorship in Venezuela. Right now, Obama is either copying Chavez or they're both reading from the same playbook. In that, you well know it, Obama is attacking Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is a perfect person for them to attack in that he has been carrying the water for the Republican Party for many years, and he's entitled to do that. And certainly if I had to choose between backing Rush Limbaugh and backing the Obama gang, I would choose Rush Limbaugh. I am glad they're attacking Rush because eventually the American people will come to understand the dangerous gang that has taken over this country. The fact of the matter is it's unprecedented in the United States of America for a sitting administration to attack someone in the media who criticizes them. I do not know that this has occurred to this extent. I am not aware of it. So if you wish to correct me, you can call me at 1-800-449-8255. I'm trying to show you that the gang, the Obama gang, is showing their true nature on a daily basis. Yesterday, I tried to educate you and enlighten you by reading from Sinclair Lewis's great book, It Can't Happen Here, written during the last during the Great Depression. Some would argue that this is a greater depression that's only simply being masked over or stuccoed over by the Obama maniacs with their insane spending. But it was written, published in 1935, I believe. And I talked about the 15 points of victory that would be announced by the candidate for the United States presidency should a dictatorship arise. And Sinclair Lewis feared it would be a right-wing dictatorship. But of course, at this point, it doesn't matter what the dictatorship, whether it comes from the right or the left, it's coming from the left in the form of Obama. Ladies and gentlemen, many of you don't understand that we are living in a dictatorship. All right, let's move on. Here's what's on michaelsavage.com. Well, hello, American Jewish community. Hillary Clinton has stabbed Jews in Israel in the back, and you thought that she would do otherwise, eh? She criticized Israel's plans to demolish dozens of Palestinian homes in Arab East Jerusalem as a violation of its international obligations. In other words, Hillary has taken the side of the UN. You expected something different from a carpetbagger from Arkansas? The world is turned upside down, but you people in New York have always been upside down, particularly you liberals. Timothy Geithner, the Boy Scout running U.S. Treasury, says that tax increases on those who earn money is necessary to limit future budget deficits. In other words, he's leading the charge against the successful and punishing the successful in order to reward the deadbeats. Also on my website, conservative Brits are furious that Ted Kennedy Chappaquiddick Ted is going to get a knighthood. It's amazing to me what goes on in this world. It's amazing to me how degenerate the liberal, worldwide liberal establishment is. Here you got what's going on here in England is that you have a guy like Ted Kennedy who is a tarnished man. Everybody knows he swam away from Mary Jo Kopechne. That's a young girl who he left to die. Everybody knows that. Let's put his politics aside. That diminishes and tarnishes the whole meaning of the word knighthood. Hugo Chavez targets media to raise his popularity. Apparently Obama is copying Chavez, or Chavez is copying Obama. I suspect, I don't know. Chavez said every mayor must make an analysis and ask how many radio stations are there in your city. What is the content of the programs? Does that give you goosebumps? Is it eerily familiar to what the Obama gang is doing in this country to conservatives and talk radio? Well, it should if you're a red-blooded American.
Savage.
There's no doubt that Obama was chosen by the mainstream, midstream media to be our president. Even if other more qualified candidates had to fall, even the Clinton political machine was brought down so that Obama would be crowned. Documentary filmmaker John Ziegler has a new film entitled Media Malpractice, How Obama Got Elected and Palin Was Targeted. It's now out on DVD, and he joins us now to talk about it. John Ziegler, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today.
What motivated you to do the documentary?
Well, this documentary really began as I was finishing up my first documentary, which was called Blocking the Path to 9/11, which was about the censorship of the ABC docudrama in 2006, The Path to 9/11. And the reason why it led to this documentary was that during the Democratic primaries, having made a film that was focused on the Clintons, I was keenly aware of just how dramatic the difference was in the coverage of Barack Obama as compared to the coverage of Hillary Clinton. And I, as a conservative, was actually finding myself in the odd position of feeling almost sorry for Hillary Clinton because of this unprecedented bias. In fact, it was beyond bias in the coverage that we were seeing in the primaries. And then once Sarah Palin became part of the equation, this phenomenon was injected with steroids. And we really left the gravitational pull of the earth when it came to all rationality and fairness in the media coverage. So I actually purchased our website for the film, HowObamaGotElected.com, back in July of last year, because I was so certain that the media was going to make sure that Barack Obama got elected. Now, of course, Sarah Palin, for a short period of time, brought that into grave question, but I think that was actually why the media attack on her, the targeting of her, was ramped up, and that's why we titled the film Media Malpractice, How Obama Got Elected and Palin Was Targeted.
How was Obama chosen as the one?
What transpired was the media was so positive that Hillary was going to win that they saw no purpose in pointlessly vetting and perhaps bloodying up this smart, charismatic, very liberal black man with a promising future. They just saw no purpose in it. They knew Hillary would win, and they thought that by elevating Obama, they would create some faux drama, which would be good for ratings, it would be good for the storyline, it would mean that the primaries would go beyond just Iowa and New Hampshire, and they'd have something to talk about for the entire winter and perhaps into spring. But in the end, Hillary would win, maybe Obama would be her vice presidential nominee, he perhaps would just set himself up for a potential run in 2012, and everyone would go home happy. But something incredible happened in the process. The media started to realize, hey, we might actually be able to pull this thing off. People are actually buying this Obama business. The ratings on MSNBC are going through the roof every time Obama is on the air. And they realized, wow, this is actually a way better story. This is way better for ratings. McCain versus Hillary looks kind of boring, but Obama into the mix, this is new, exciting, and this is historic. Why it's more historic to have the first black president than the first female president, I don't know. But there's no question that the liberal white guilt that pervades the news media had a lot of play in creating the circumstances where the media dumped their favorites, the Clintons, in favor of Barack Obama. But that's clearly what happened, and we prove it in media malpractice.
Why do you say Palin was targeted?
Well, because Sarah Palin was a threat, and Sarah Palin was a threat in many ways. First of all, she was a threat to the election of their guy, the media's guy, Barack Obama. Obviously, once Palin was picked and made that spectacular convention speech, the McCain-Palin team rocketed to a lead, what would be their only real lead, in the polls. And so at that point, she was a threat to them that way. She was also a threat in that they tried to destroy her right off the bat, and she proved them wrong with that convention speech. So she was a threat not only to their candidate, but also to their credibility. And she was also a threat, I think, on a deeper level, in that her biography was such that it kind of threatened the entire liberal notion of what a woman ought to be. I mean, here is a woman who, with five kids, who was extremely successful, still clearly having sex with her husband, loves her husband, kills her own food, and is extremely attractive while pulling all of this off. That is very threatening to a lot of women, especially women who are insecure about themselves. And women like that like nothing more than to see a woman like Sarah Palin be brought down to size. And that's why stories about her were automatic ratings winners, because women love to see that kind of story. That's really kind of the basis for reality television, is that female phenomenon. And I think that Sarah Palin was targeted largely because of that. So it really was a perfect storm situation.
Where does it go from here?
Well, there's no question that the same kind of media coverage that got Obama elected is going to be pervasive throughout his presidency. And that's one of the reasons why I've made this documentary, Media Malpractice, because from a historical standpoint, I'm trying to correct the historical record as to what really happened and make sure that this precedent does not stand, because if this precedent stands, then it will stand forever and it will only get worse in the future, and it will certainly impact Barack Obama's reelection, because to the news media, Barack Obama is AIG. He's too big to fail. They essentially own his presidency because they're the ones that provided it to him. Their credibility is on the line. They are not going to allow him to be a one-termer if they can do anything about it. And so that is why I've made this documentary, so that the public at least has the ability to know the real and full truth about what really transpired with regard to the media coverage here. This is not really about bashing President Obama, although there certainly is some of that in the film. There's actually more bashing of Joe Biden than there is of President Obama in the film. But it's more about setting the record straight about this dangerous and unprecedented nature of the media coverage of the 2008 election so that it doesn't happen again in the future, for instance, 2012 or beyond.
Is the media love affair ending soon? I doubt it.
No. I don't think it will be over because I think the media's credibility is very much hooked onto the wagon of the Barack Obama presidency. They're the ones that created this phenomenon. Now, I do agree that there is a media MO of building someone up only to tear them down. But I will be stunned if we ever really see Barack Obama torn down anywhere near the way, for instance, George W. Bush was torn down by the news media. It just will go against everything in their nature from the political perspective, from the racial standpoint, from the fact that they love this guy personally, from the fact that they're the ones that vouched for his credibility and were able to diminish all the negative stories about him to pave his way for the presidency. It's hard for me to imagine. Now, stranger things, I guess, have happened, but it's hard for me to imagine without some major scandal occurring that the media is really ever going to leave Barack Obama, at least until he is reelected. Once he's reelected, then I think we might see some change in that because at least history will record that he was a two-termer and he was not a complete disaster, and therefore the media could justify what they did in 2008. But before that, I would be very, very surprised to see the media turn on him.
Well, what's the main point you want people to take away from your documentary?
I guess the most important thing for people to know about this film is that it tells the entire story of the presidential campaign through the prism of how the news media impacted events. And what we've done here is we have told a story that no one else has been able to tell. You can't do this in a book. You can't do this in a short television piece. It can only be done in a documentary. On the DVD that we're selling at HowObamaGotElected.com, we're also putting the entire Sarah Palin interview on that DVD so people can see the real Sarah Palin from her living room talking openly and honestly about the real nature of the media coverage that transpired in 2008, as well as our infamous Obama voter video, which has gotten over 2 million YouTube hits, which we put out just after the election, which has absolutely hilarious interviews with Obama voters after they exited the polls, which shows how little they knew about what they were voting for.
I think people are finally starting to see the truth about BO. John Ziegler, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks so much, Michael.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Certain things about the left don't make any sense. That's why I say liberalism is a mental disorder. Joining us now is Jamie Glazov, author of United in Hate, The Left's Romance with Tyranny and Terror. And the book talks about the left's self-destructive behavior by reaching out to Marxism and radical Islamists. Jamie, what motivated you to write your book?
Thank you, Michael. Look, the story behind the book, I think the most important thing for me to start with is my story. Michael, I come from the Soviet Union. I was born in a monstrous regime. I was born in a totalitarian environment, and that was a despotism, one of the most evil regimes in world history that massacred millions of its people and barbarically and viciously oppressed them. And let me tell you this, my parents were dissidents. They stood up for freedom. They stood up for liberty. They sacrificed almost their lives, and we were able to escape the Soviet Union. Now, Michael, when we came to the United States as a young boy, I fell in love with America. My family fell in love with America. We fell in love with freedom and liberty, and we cherished this country. Now, as I grew older, I ran into a species called leftists. I ran into the left, and These were people that were telling me that I was a liar, that communism wasn't so bad, that my parents should shut up, that it's the United States that's the most evil country in the world, that communism, you know, is just, if not just as bad, it may even be better. And they cheered for the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And I was very mystified by that. And there was anger in my heart because my life was spent worrying about Vladimir Bukovsky and Natan Sharansky and Andrei Sakharov and all the persecuted people behind the Iron Curtain. So look, all of a sudden, 9/11 happened. Now, this was after the defeat of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapsed. The Cold War was over. And the left seemed very depressed during that time. There was an interval there. All of a sudden, 9/11 hit. We had criminals, terrorists, perpetrate a crime against humanity. And that's what 9/11 was. There were terrorists that got on civilian airlines and drove those planes into heavily populated buildings with innocent people. And you know what I noticed, and I predicted it, and I knew it was coming? My leftist acquaintances, my leftist friends, and all the leftists on the international world stage, they celebrated that atrocity. They were happy the United States was hit, and they reached their hands out in solidarity to not just the terrorists themselves, but to the whole ideology in radical Islam. And after 9/11, and after what I saw happening in Iraq, and yet the left was on the side of our enemies and wanted to see us fail. So I decided to finally expose the left for what it was, examining and analyzing the impulses that motivate leftists to reach out to despots, to monsters.
Well, why does the left reach out to these regimes that would be the first to imprison them?
Michael, that's a crucial question right there. Now, look, a lot of people think that this is bizarre, that it's a paradox, that it doesn't make any sense of why leftists would do this. Let me just draw a very simple picture. The leftists in general, leftists overall, believe that they can create a perfect world. They hate this society. They hate the United States. They hate capitalism. They don't like the fact that life comes with hierarchy, with inequality, with chance, that humans have self-interest, that things are imperfect. They believe that they can build a classless utopia. Now, the leftist, in believing this, needs to create a paradise on Earth, and he wants to create a disinfected, pure utopia. Now, in order to do this, there needs to be a transformation. So, therefore, the new Earth needs to be built on the ashes of the old earth. In other words, there has to be bloodshed and there has to be destruction. And we saw that throughout the whole 20th century. We saw it in the Soviet Union. We saw it under Mao and in China. We saw Castro's Cuba. We saw Vietnam. Wherever heaven was attempted to be built by leftists and communists, they produced hell. Now, in today's struggle, it's very, very understandable. The left wants ground zero. They want destruction. They hate their own society. Who is it that's going to do it? Who's helping it? Look at radical Islam. They also want to create utopia, but their utopia is the Islamist utopia. It's Sharia. They believe that by building Islamist utopia, they also can have a heaven on earth, but it also necessitates destruction. And guess who needs to be destroyed? The United States, democracy, and capitalism. In other words, both want to perpetrate ground zero because upon the ashes of ground zero, a new utopia can be built on that territory. And so they hate humanity, they hate life, and they hate man for who and what he is. And that's why they're united in hate.
Why do the neo-Marxist feminists ignore what is going on under radical Islamist rule in the Middle East?
Well, look, that's an excellent question, and this is a big part of my book. Michael, what really motivated me, what really inspired me, was also the anger in my guts, in my heart, because so much of my life is dedicated to the 6,000 girls a day that are viciously mutilated, female genital mutilation, 6,000 girls a day in the Islamic world. It's happening right now, and it's happening because of Islamic theology and what the clerics are teaching. I'm not saying that all Muslims do it, but what I am saying is that there is a fact, and it's happening to 6,000 a day. They try to stop this in Egypt, and the clerics made sure that it kept going. I'm worried about the stonings of women. I care about the women that are forcibly segregated, forced marriage, honor killings. And you know what? Where are the leftist feminists? If they really care about women, where are they? Why aren't they standing up for women who are suffering under Islamic gender apartheid? And it's the same thing. That's what United in Hate is showing. There's a long tradition. We've got leftist intellectuals who venerated and praised societies where intellectuals were murdered and imprisoned, and these leftist intellectuals themselves would be killed and imprisoned there. There's a death wish impulse, and it's very important to see this because it leads to real destructive behavior. Now, it also leads to destructive policies.
Is this what you see going on with Obama and his gang?
In the beginning, I was somewhat hopeful. Obama showed some good signs in the beginning. He seemed to pick a pretty strong war cabinet. He seems to support a surge in Afghanistan. There appear to be no significant big left turns in foreign policy, and a lot of radical leftists were very upset. So things seemed good for a minute, but look at what's happening now. I mean, let's just talk about the closing of Guantanamo. Let's talk about the closing of the CIA interrogation centers worldwide. Listen, Michael, do you know, and I'm sure you do, how much information was gathered through those vehicles during the Bush administration? That information helped the United States stop so many 9/11s, and not just more 9/11s, but even bigger, perhaps even WMD attacks with biological weapons or chemical weapons. So it's very worrying now that the Bush administration is gone, and we have a new administration that's literally tying our hands behind our back in this terror war, and it's happening because of leftist ideology. But look, we just had a beheading in Buffalo, and the mainstream media isn't saying a word about it. A Muslim husband chopped the head off of his wife, and due to a lot of the details that are coming out about it, it appears that there's a lot involved in terms of Islamic teachings. We know that this was an honor killing. Look, up in Toronto, we had a 16-year-old girl, Aksa Parvez, killed last year because she refused to wear the veil. We have Geert Wilders in London that wasn't even allowed into England because the British are afraid to allow free speech because they're afraid of Muslim violence. Look, if you're interested and if you care about protecting and safeguarding the freedom that makes this country the great country that it is, it's time for all of us to get on the front lines. And I wrote United in Hate to help us clarify and to crystallize what the mindset is of the enemy forces that wish our country harm.
Thanks, Jamie. Your book proves my point that liberalism is a mental disorder, and a very dangerous one at that. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.